Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Achtung, Achtung. Yes, we're going with a German for this very, very special Thursday edition of We Have Ways of Making You Talk. With me, at home here, sat on my sofa, James Holland in what looks like a restyled barn. And yep. He's got some...
That's exactly what it is. That is exactly what
green,
it is.
Olive green cosplay for us. And we're very, very fortunate to be joined by Professor Daniel Todman. Welcome, Daniel.
Hi.
Is it Dan, Daniel, Dan?
Dan.
Dan. Welcome, Dan. Now,
we really should... can I just say, we really should have just said danger, danger today.
All right. Okay. Danger, danger. There you are. You're happy now?
Yeah, I am. Well, you know, we're talking about Britain's war, aren't we?
Yes. So, Dan, you have... Well, imminent to be published is your second volume of Britain's War. The first volume, incredibly well received. An astonishing book that my mother not so long ago said, have you read this? It's very long, but it's awfully good. And I can't remember where she just got to. So I did not know that all that was going on at that point. And I've been very fortunate to have read the second volume. It must be a relief to get to the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, it's felt like a long time. It's, you know, it's the two books cover 37 to 47, so yeah. And it's taken the best part of two decades to write. So this has been a big chunk of my life.
Goodness me! So that's the first thing we should maybe flag up for people who don't know either volume. They don't know the first volume, and they're soon to know the second. Is that you start in 1937 and you finish in 1947? Now, obviously. When the Second World War actually starts, or whatever you want to, the umbrella term Second World War, after all, actually starts is a thing that you can argue about, because it doesn't start for the argument doesn't start for the Soviet Union until July of 1941. Although probably and in Japan and China, you know, blah 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 blah. But why did you decide? Because the other thing is, this is Britain at war. This is not a history of the Second World War in itself, is it?
No. So it's focused very specifically on Britain and its empire. But by their nature, those are global things. So you have to think about what's going on around the planet. But also, I was very conscious that you can't really understand what's happening in 1939 if you start with at the moment the war breaks out.
Yeah.
That actually you have to start a bit earlier. And similarly, at the other end of the conflict, if you just stop in August 1945, you don't understand the implications of the war or how they're playing out. So you need to take it to at least 1947. So that gets you to the British departure from India, but also the onset of the Cold War. The start of what will become the Marshall Plan, so that you can see how things have changed.
How did you pick that end? The end, though, because you know, Cyprus, Aden, basically go through my father's military career, post war 50s and 60s military career. You could, because Britain's Second World War, I mean, arguably, is still going on. The way people talk about the war and the way it sits in culture, it's still incredibly present in a way it may not be in other participants. How did you pick 1947?
Well, two reasons. First, I think actually you can see the shift. Britain's post-war, So the period of uncertainty that you get right at the when the fighting stops about what will happen next. People are very uncertain about how's the world going to be reshaped. Actually, that period doesn't last very long. So I think by the time you get to the end of 1947, you can see the direction things are going to go in. So that's one reason. And the other reason is, unlike James, I don't have the mental or physical strength to write three big volumes about the Second World War.
He's only written two.
Yeah. Oh, he's another one to come, though.
I'm dreading it.
The books are comprehensive, though, aren't they? Because James, you're very much the military end of things, really. Although your books take in the bigger scale, but the thing I was really struck by with the second volume, the thing that really caught my imagination was Britain interfering with the tungsten price in Spain.
It's absolutely brilliant. I've got to say, can I just pitch in here? Because I think this is the thing that I just think is so fascinating. It's that broader part of the war. It's that what I would categorize into the operational level. It's the nuts and bolts of how it all works, how you fit it together. You know, and that what you get very clearly from the books is that sense of Britain's position in the world, which of course is completely different then as to what it is now. And I think one of the reasons why everyone has been so down on Britain and Britain's war effort in the last 40, 50 years, in that kind of sort of declinist view, is because people find it so hard to kind of equate the Britain of 1937 to 47 with the Britain of the 70s, 80s and 90s. And obviously Britain changes a lot in that decade that you're writing about, Dan, but it is still a very, very different Britain then to what it is now, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, it's a country which can exercise a huge amount of international leverage. There's a paradox there because it's incredibly militarily powerful, particularly by the time you get to 1944, but at the same time it's experienced a really rapid decline in its international power relative to the United States and the Soviet Union. So I think those two things go along at the same time.
Yes, well, that's the really interesting thing, isn't it? Because the boats all float, don't they? And at the same time as those three economies turn their war effort full bore to dealing with, and of course the problem the Germans encounter is that they're in 1939 they are running at what 25% of GDP on something like that on armaments, and the British are still on 4 or something. So the slack that a similar sized economy, and that we're just talking about the British economy rather than British imperial economy, that the slack in the British economy is considerable, but the slack in the American economy and the Soviet economy will obviously override any effort that Britain can come to. So you do get that sort of levelling up, I suppose, is the current expression.
Well, it's that extraordinary ability to co-opt American power, particularly American industrial power. And I think that's one of the things that really struck me about writing the first volume, was that actually, you know, of course, we concentrate on Britain's dollar reserves running out, the dependence on America from 1941. But actually, the amount that Britain spends in the United States before that point,
it's absolutely phenomenal, isn't it?
Yeah. And an awful lot of the speed with which the US can come into the war from the end of 1941 is dependent on that investment that's already taken place.
You're absolutely right, because Roosevelt is able to maneuver from this incredibly isolationist, inward-looking, kind of don't spend anything on defence approach to this total political volte-face, where he's saying, I want billions, and I want to be producing 50,000 aircraft a year, which is just extraordinary. But the reason he's able to do that is because he's saying, we're going to get rich on it, and we're going to make it for the Allies so that we don't have to fight. And that's how he is able to kind of convince the corridors of Washington and the great American people.
But those decisions are made in early 1940, aren't they? Because aircraft take 9 months to build.
May and June, I think, is sort of ground zero for Britain and for America, because obviously we've had the defeat in France, the army's been there, the equipment's been left behind. It's kind of, okay, let's start again. From Britain's point of view, he's got to kind of think, okay, well, we're never planning on having a large army. We've never traditionally had a large army. You know, the French were going to do that bit. Now we've got to create an army. What's that army going to look like? It's going to be 55 divisions. What America has to do is say, okay, we've had almost no military whatsoever, apart from a bit of naval power. We've now got to kind of crank it up
big time. But it is British money that enables Roosevelt to kickstart that armament process, so that 18 months on, because it's an 18th month process, it's 6 months to get the machine tools made and everything set up, it's another 6 months to get everyone into gear and start producing stuff, and it's another 6 months before, you know, the factories are starting to churn out anything of any substantial number. And what is really, really intriguing is that those decisions are made in kind of May and June 1940 in Washington, and 18 months on, conveniently, is when Japan then attacks Pearl Harbor and they enter the war. It's a coincidence.
Steady on. If you were to go back to London, I think one of the things that the Chamberlain government doesn't get enough credit for, if plenty of things to criticise it about, but that actually that decision to spend loads of money on aircraft engine factories in the US happens before the crisis in Europe in May 1940.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you think of the atomic bomb project as being one of the, you know, the big things that the Americans spend money on during the Second World War, not the most expensive thing they do, but a very expensive project. Britain spends the same amount of money in dollars in the US before on aircraft factories before America comes into the war. Yeah. So that's a really big head start.
The British government take on all the inherit all the French contracts, don't they, when France falls. So that's just as a matter of course, and that there isn't, because obviously the Americans don't want to lose those contracts. So they of course those contracts are still open, rather than oh dear, the French will default, we're going to have to shut this capacity down. It is really interesting that because of course the story we tell ourselves is Britain on its own in the summer of 1940, the imagery of the few makes the RAF not sound like this enormous integrated muscular wing of national defence, because after all the RAF, you know, the pilot, there's one pilot and then 20 blokes to make that all happen. And so that actually what we're talking about is Britain's incredible muscle at the start of the war that kind of gets overlooked.
Yes, but also I think the ability to look forward and say, however weak Britain seems in 1939 and 1940, it's going to get stronger. And by the time you get to 1942, that's when, you know, in terms of the plans there are at the start of the war, that's when you might be able to launch the decisive offensive if the German economy hasn't broken by that point.
Yeah, which of course it doesn't quite. So
no, but I think that ability to look forward with confidence, again, is almost too easily overlooked from a British point of view now. You know, so because we know the end of the war, right? So the idea that you can think. Actually, if it takes a long time,
but this is a thing we've talked about before, about that after Dunkirk, it is remarkable that the army is able to sort of dust itself down and go, all right, well, okay, that didn't go very well. How do we beat these people? What have we got to do? That the government systems, that, you know, the War Office, the Air Ministry, they're all able to do that as well. Rather than, I mean, because they're compelling reasons to throw in the towel in the summer of 1940.
Sure. There's no reason in the towel in 1940. There's no
Your
reason
army has been routed.
Yes, I know, but the army's tiny.
Kicked out
the army's
of Europe.
Tiny. That's the French do the army bit. You know, we do the navy, and we still got the world's largest navy in the summer of 1940. The world's largest merchant fleet. We've got access to around 80% of the world's merchant shipping. I mean, those are pretty big advantages. You've got huge empire, dominions, all the rest of it.
But you still have to find the political will, though. That's the thing, isn't
yes,
it?
That's the big thing. I think 19, you know, second half of May 1940 is just this just total shock. Everyone's so completely discombobulated because no one could see this coming. And so it's so shocking. It's making people kind of not see reason. And I think one of the, you know, we've talked about it before, but I think one of the things that's so intriguing is that the man who's supposed to be so reasonable and sensible and have the soundest head on any shoulders in the country, in Lord Halifax, is the one who's kind of not thinking rationally particularly. And the one who's supposed to have a very, very dodgy reputation in terms of his judgment is the one who is actually thinking clearly, which of course is Churchill. And I would also agree with you, Dan, that I think Chamberlain is much maligned, and a lot of it is extremely unfair. One thing I would say is when you were writing the two books, did you start with a kind of the sort of the acorn of a thesis, Or did you just think, I'm going to look at this and I'm going to... I mean, how did it evolve that you started to kind of think, actually, what needs to be done here is a much more in-depth examination of how Britain conducted her war? I mean, was that always the intention and you didn't know what your conclusions were going to be? Or did you already have a pretty good idea of where you were... Where you were heading with this?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I started off knowing that I wanted to tell a story that connected the military, the social, the political, the economic. And actually that comes out of my previous life as a First World War historian.
Right.
And there's a fantastic book about the First World War, Britain and the First World War, The Myriad Faces of War by Trevor Wilson, which is a book that I loved when I was first studying the First World War. Mm. And it takes exactly that approach. And I was very conscious that there wasn't an equivalent for Britain's Second World War. So I thought that was the germ of the idea. And then I was very fortunate to have an editor at Penguin, Simon Winder, who understood that.
Yes.
This would take big books. So what he said was, there's no point doing a short book about Britain in the Second World War because it'll just be a list of things that happened. If you want to actually say things that are interesting, you've got to unpack a lot of the alternatives. That's one of the interesting things, particularly about that middle bit of the war, is all that planning for things that didn't happen. So if you're going to explore all of that, you need space to do it. And then that's how what was originally going to be one book turned into two very big volumes. And I knew that I knew some key points I wanted to make, particularly about how we think about whether Britain was strong or not. What did strong mean?
Yep.
But also that, you know, there are those two narratives about the war, aren't there, that are common in popular culture. One is 1940 as this moment of defiance.
Yes.
So I wanted to unpack, what does that mean exactly? How is it that Britain could be defiant then?
Yep.
And the other is about the end of the war, and was it really a victory, or was it somehow taken away from Britain? Was Britain adequately recompensed for what it had sacrificed? And in both cases, I just wanted to make those... to make readers feel that they could come to their own judgment about those two things. So I'm not a big believer in historians telling people everything you think is a myth, recast it. Because it's a bit like that.
You've got to show, don't tell. That's the point.
Yeah, it's like that Gary Larson cartoon of what we say and what dogs hear, right? You know, bad dog Fido, and what Fido hears is Fido. So don't press the button that says myth. Just show to people that what you might think is something quite simple, and we live in a world where people often think that things are simple, is more complicated, and you can think about it from different directions.
Well, I completely agree with that. I think it's one of the really interesting things is unpicking it. And, you know... You and I both well know that a lot of the narrative histories of the Second World War, they really do just focus on the strategic overview and what's going on at the coalface.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
What was the shipping cycle for getting tanks from the US to Alexandria for the Alamein, for the Second Battle of Alamein? Because there's 400 Shermans are delivered, of course, to that battle, which then gives Montgomery this preponderance of armour that up to that point, and they're brand new and they're funky and all that, cutting edge. What's the, you know, how long does that all take? Because you're looking at long range planning that, like James says, makes your head hurt.
But that's quite quick,
right?
Those shipments, because that decision's taken what, June, July,
yep,
and they're in place October.
Yep.
So you know, that's quite a quick decision, a movement of tanks. Mm. So if things need to be done in an emergency, it's possible to reorder shipping in all sorts of ways. One of the reasons that everybody at the Ministry of Shipping finds Churchill such an infuriating boss is because he will sometimes say, this has to happen now. But of course, every time you do that, you disturb everything else. And it's the long-term system of convoys that you've got to plan out, assembling the shipping, building them up to transport stuff either from the US across to the UK, or from the UK down and around the Cape up through the Red Sea. That takes a long time just to get all the ships in one place. It's not just the voyages by themselves.
And the other problem you've got is you've got this inefficiency that suddenly with a convoy, you know, in the good old days of individual sailings, you know, one comes in on Tuesday morning, another on Wednesday afternoon, then on Thursday. So your stevedores, your guys, your dock workers, they're all kind of, there's just a constant flow. What happens with convoys is suddenly you've got 42 ships arriving in Liverpool all at once. And then in between, you've got nothing. So it's a really inefficient way of loading and unloading. But it's the only way you can do it that will enable you to be safe. And, you know, that is just a whole nother logistical headache and time constraint that you've got to factor into your planning.
Well, yeah, and I mean, in some ways, I think trying to reinforce Malaya and Singapore in the spring of 42 is a better example than trying to get tanks across for Second Alamein. Yeah. Because you've got to go around the Cape, it takes, you know, it's a month cycle before you can get anything to the Middle East. So are you going to rejig something from the Middle East, which you were expecting to use either to centre the Soviet Union, to keep the Soviets in the fight, or to follow up on Rommel after he's been defeated in the winter battle? Are you going to send all of that out to the Far East now? If you do that, where are the ships going to come from to do it? You know, so, you know, it only takes a displacement somewhere in the system for the knock-on effects to be really huge.
Struck in the first book, there's the stuff about the refrigeration ships, which of course are really important for the for getting, you in peacetime use for getting meat from New Zealand to the UK essentially, and they become incredibly important because of the size and all that sort of thing, and so they have to be what on earth you do with these ships and where you fit them in becomes actually a thing that dominates thinking at one point. And then you've got the business of ports being attacked, ship damage, and so you may have a big fleet, but a shipping fleet, but at times it can't, like James says, because of convoy congestion, it can't be used particularly effectively. So you've got to plan around all that, and this is before we get to, you know, were cruiser tanks any good, and the 6-pounder, the stuff that often I love our listeners dearly, but we do get asked a lot of kind of those kind of questions, where people get hung up on tank types and all that sort of thing. When we zoom out, and this, what do we do? How do we get this refrigeration ship from one end of the world to the other at the moment we need it? It's sort of fantastic.
But it also makes you think about two things. One is what is the experience of British servicemen in particular, that for most of them, for the majority of the war, their war will start with a lengthy voyage aboard ship.
Yes.
And that's quite distinctive to the British and American, Canadian, Australian experience in a way that it's not for the Russian and German experience.
Yeah.
Right. So these aren't servicemen who are getting into battle by train, right? At least not at the beginning of their journeys. But the other thing is what actually affects the British home front, that actually the biggest falls in imports that you'll see during the war are not caused because there's been some unexpected sinkings by U-boats. They're caused because the US quartermasters want to send a bit more across the Atlantic, or they need some more supplies to send.
Or the Tunisia campaign has gone on a bit longer than it was intended, you know, which is also really interesting. And I think one of the most fascinating decisions that's made out of the Casablanca conference in January 1943 is the decision to end the Battle of the Atlantic once and for all, because until you've done that, it's really, really hard to plan a major operation, because you don't know how much shipping you've got coming through. If you know that 98% of your shipping's coming through, you can plan properly for Operation Husky, or more importantly in the case of the Allies, Operation Overlord. But it's very, very difficult to plan for something like that if you know, you're getting a convoy of 42 ships and 14 of them are being sunk. You know, so there is this huge necessity to sort out the Atlantic once and for all so that you can properly plan, because the planning of shipping is so complicated.
But it's true enough, because the other thing to remember about Casablanca is what the British do there, because they want so much from the Americans at that conference, is agree to do all sorts of things with no account to the shipping that they've got available at all. And it's only later, only in March 43, that they say, oh, actually, there aren't enough ships to do this, so all those things we promised you, sorry, we can't do them. Yeah. So I find that's that fascinating combination between, you're astonished that anybody could plan all of this in the days before computers. Yeah.
Excel. Yeah.
And at the same time, lots of it's done without the planning. You just make the decision and then make it work afterwards.
But, well, and the British do play fast and loose with the Americans sometimes, because again, from the first book, I was struck by the thing about the grain. That at one point, we have so much grain that we've got out of the Americans, it spoils and is never used. And so the Americans, after that, start thinking, well, I don't know if we can really trust your estimates on food anymore. You've wasted shipping space. You've taken the mickey, really. I think that's really, really interesting. There's some gaming going on by the British government throughout the war of the Americans.
I'm nodding away frantically, which is a terrible thing to do on a podcast.
Yeah, it's not. You're not helping me here.
I think it's often very hard to work out in those negotiations at all different levels who exactly is playing who. And of course, these are negotiations in which often, you know, particular Anglo-American personalities will find that they get on very well and cooperate together. But as kind of state institutions, they're allies who are also jealous of each other's power.
Yep.
Who want to get something out of the other institution. And there's quite often times where you think, well, all these different multiple bits of information that are being passed back and forward, I don't think that's something where you can call it right or wrong. But very often what you think when you read through those accounts is this is about really devious use of power.
Yep.
And that's something I think I find fascinating. Mm. You know, I think stories that run at all different levels how do you use... This is a war that gives people a lot of power.
Well, because you could argue that one of the American war aims is to dismantle the British Empire.
Yep.
I mean, I would argue that the opportunity comes along. It's all those British holdings that are part of Lend-Lease that get gobbled up, that have to be handed over as part of Lend-Lease, and then obviously bases and all that. The bases are the things people talk about, but there's British companies that the Americans say, well, you're going to have to hand that over, I'm afraid. And that's all the thumb screws are applied, which I think is really, really interesting. When people talk about the special relationship, yeah, fine, but
so that's what I think is so fascinating about the second half of the war, and particularly 43 to 47, is the extent to which the British are fighting to hold on to what power they've got, and that's really hard.
Yeah.
And that it involves giving concessions when they have to, or using something that they can offer to the Americans because they're useful in different ways.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually what makes that rearguard action is in some ways tremendously successful, because of the amount of power that Britain is able to retain. Yeah. I mean, retain in a very different world in which it's very dependent on American economic support. And that's what you see. That's why I think it's so important to carry the story to 47.
Yeah.
You see all that Marshall aid about to head across the Atlantic. And yet, it's not been the kind of catastrophic decline which you might have predicted earlier in the war, or that you would have seen, I think, had Britain come to a settlement with Germany in 1940, then the curve downwards
would have been
a lot steeper,
harder and faster. Yeah.
I still think one of the things that's most I find repeatedly incredible, though, is certainly from the kind of military point of view, and to a certain extent political point of view as well, is actually just how well they rub together. I mean, you know, successive historians have continually repeated the kind of rampant Anglophobia and Americophobia of leading commanders and stuff, and they always kind of pick out pattern and so on. But actually, I think what is amazing is that, you know, they are coalition partners. They're not, you know, ironically, they're not actual proper allies. And actually, when you think about it, what's remarkable is how well they get on and how well they cooperate as coalition partners to get what they need done. And I think one of the things that I'm increasingly convinced about is that, by and large, Germany doesn't make the best use of its meagre resources. Whereas, by and large, and you can obviously argue the toss over individual things, but on the whole, Britain and America prioritise their assets really, really well, I think. And I think that's one of the big factors why, ultimately, they're so successful, and why, ultimately, at the end of the war, despite having fought this incredibly tough, brutal, violent war, their casualty figures are so comparatively few compared to the other main combatants.
Yeah, I mean, I think militarily they get on incredibly well. And it's a good example of, you know, what you were talking in terms of previous accounts being land-centric. If you look at the Navy and the Air Forces, Britain and America, actually, you know, the level of cooperation there is very high. The level of effectiveness is very high. Politically, yes, I think there's a much bigger difference. And particularly as you get to the end of the war, one of the things I think is interesting is there's, you know, as David Edgerton would say, there's this internationalist moment during the war when everybody feels they're part of this great worldwide alliance. But when you get to 44, 45, as the end of the war comes in sight, nationalist feeling grows not just in the US, but also in the UK. And that's what a lot of the texts that we have that tell us about how brilliant Britain was, everything that it did by itself, they all come from that moment in 1944. Well, when Britain's trying to convince the Americans, we've sacrificed all this stuff, give us some aid.
Yeah. Well, because you do get that shift from an imperial tenor to the British war effort in 1940-41-42, and then Singapore falls. That's the moment of imperial total nervous breakdown and crisis, and then politics in the UK shifts to this nationalist thing. And so Labour, who've been anti-imperialist, they pivot to nationalism nationalism's too strong, a nationalist way of looking at things, and then the Tories have to as well, and so you end up in a completely different political space in 45, and you've got the manoeuvring going on of basically Churchill being sidelined on the macro level, Churchill being sidelined by Roosevelt meeting with Stalin, and eventually actually kind of frozen out almost completely. And that's emblematic, really, of because you say militarily we get on very well, but the high level politics, Britain's very much squeezed hard.
One of the interesting things about writing the second volume, because I don't have a huge amount of sympathy for Churchill, and I'm always quite keen to stick the boot in to him when I can, because I'm contrary like that.
Yeah.
And that was definitely a theme of the first book. But in the second book, actually, I had a lot more sympathy for somebody grappling with these tremendous global problems, as he sees it, and how intractable they are. And I think particularly when you look at what's happening in 1944, I mean, what's astonishing is that he's not only looking forward to the invasion of Northwest Europe, but actually that he's having to grapple with the chiefs of staff and his economic advisors about the return to empire. What's that going to look like? Is it going to be possible? About strategy in the Far East, about some kind of economic settlement that might allow reconstruction after the war. And whatever you think about him as a strategist, as a grand strategist, so as somebody who could think about how international power was wielded, he was quite acutely perceptive and willing to be persistent in trying to defend British power.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Dan. That's the end for today, but we're going to carry it. There's no stopping us talking. We'll be back next Thursday with more with Daniel Todman.
Yeah, Dan, that was absolutely fantastic. Really,
thanks for listening.
Thanks for coming on. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.